For the artists and the Directors Council on Friday night. The exhibition officially opens to the public this coming Sunday, and it runs April 5th through May 17th, so I hope you'll find time to spend with these paintings. I think it is a real treat to have the artist and the curator here actually prior to the opening of the exhibition. I think it lends us a certain advantage when we first see the paintings in this focus exhibition. These are paintings that are sure to take your breath away due to sheer scale and physicality. The chaos, which veils the underlying order and recognizable content of these paintings, draws the viewer in, maybe against their better judgment, but in fact draws them in, and then there is a moment of realization when the picture that lies under the abstract painting is found. It is an extraordinary feat for a young painter. Rosin's ability to layer image and brushwork in order to slowly reveal the complexity of these paintings, her confidence with her subject matter and her materials, have put her at the fore and have landed her solo shows such as Texas Crude that recently opened at White Cube Gallery in London, as well as this, her first museum exhibition. Rosin was born in Dallas. She received a BFA from the School of Visual Arts in New York and an MFA from Yale in 2004 before heading to L.A., where she now lives and works. In L.A., Rosin is represented by Honor Fraser Gallery, and in Paris she shows with Natalie Obadiah Gallery. Is that it? Obadiah? The Natalie Obadiah Gallery in Paris. And some of you may recall from Nicola Vassell's Tuesday evening lecture a few weeks ago, Rosin's work was in the 2008 exhibition Subtraction that explored contemporary abstract painting. It showed at Deitch Projects, where Rosin's work will now be represented in New York. And needless to say, Rosin is showing a lot of promise as a rising star at a young age. And it's Andrea Carnes, who we have to thank for bringing her here and her magnificent paintings to the modern for this lecture and for this focus exhibition. As curator at the modern for 8 years, Andrea, correct?
Yeah.
Count back. For approximately 8 years. Andrea is responsible for smart and provocative exhibitions, including Julie Bosey, Pierre Weig, 1 Million Plus Kingdom, Pretty Baby, and Hubbard and Burser, No Room to Answer. And she began the focus exhibitions, which have been a big draw for a very informed audience and sometimes a brand new audience, with the likes of Adam Fuss, Vera Luter, and Cornelia Parker for the first run, which started in 2005. These are just a few of the reasons that we, as residents of the DFW Metroplex, owe Andrea our gratitude. She has delivered every time with these focus shows, and we're so glad to have her here tonight to talk with Rosin. And what's going to happen is Andrea is going to begin by generally presenting the work of Rosin Crowe as it progressed over the past few years. Then Rosin will get up here, and she will talk about certain issues in the work, and then she will field your questions. So I encourage you that as Andrea's talking and as Rosin's talking, that you develop some really good questions, because this is your chance, so don't blow it. So with that, please join me in welcoming Rosin Crowe.
Thank you, Terry. Actually, I'm Andrea Carnes. I'm first in the lineup here. But Terry said everything about Rosin's work that I was going to say. So, no, we thought, you know, we would kind of mix it up tonight, because a lot of people ask me how the three focus shows every season are decided upon. Since it's a competitive, and I'll say this because the artist is here, highly competitive and coveted position to have a focus show here, a lot of people ask. And the short answer is that I travel to look at work in galleries and also to visit artist studios, and of course reading critiques and reviews of artists' works all the time. But since we have Rosin here with us tonight, I thought I would give sort of a mini evolution of how I first saw her work and what some questions that came to my mind were. So, This was one of the first paintings I saw of Rawson's, and it was in Kielvessel's show at Deitch Projects called Substractions. It was exactly a year ago. So the focus shows are kind of, they happen a lot faster, obviously, than the larger exhibitions here. And when I saw this painting is really very representative of Rawson's work in that it is large scale. The dimensions are up there, 84 by 144 inches. This is called Montana Men's Booth, World's Fair, 1904. So this is representative in that it's very painterly, it's large scale, very seductive, empty, lush interiors. This characterizes much of Rawson's work. And it also has this Baroque quality, this Baroque quality and this very masculine quality as well. And as Terry mentioned, there are these abstract passages mixed with representation. So some of the basic questions that came to mind for me when I first saw this and another painting of Rawson's were, what aspects of this are historical? What aspects are nostalgic? What is invented? What is conflated about the image? And also, I thought about what might attract her to these sort of uber masculine, macho spaces. And the obvious, why is the figure left out? So, in researching a little bit more about her, and by the way, thank you to Aaron Starr-White, who is here tonight, for putting this PowerPoint together and finding these images. In researching more about her, I figured out that Rawson's very interested in the idea of myth and of America's raucous past. And so this idea of the Wild West. So I began to look at some images like these to try to figure out where her inspiration may have come. This was before I met Rawson, actually. So this is a saloon image and then a gambling scene. And in looking at more of Rawson's images on Honor Fraser's website, you know, I kind of figured out that there was a certain flavor there, a certain nostalgia for this kind of Wild West. Here's another. I think this one that Aaron found is hilarious. A staged stagecoach robbery. but the idea, again, is that, you know, how much of this is myth? How much of what we think when we see images like this is invented in our own mind, you know, and through series like Deadwood, which I happen to love. And then Rawson wrote an essay for her exhibition at White Cube at Hoxton Square. That show was called Texas Crude, and it just closed a couple of months ago. And she wrote an essay called Stars and Bars, America's Frontier Baroque. And she sent me the essay before the catalog came out so I could begin to read more about what she was thinking about her own work. And also in the interim, I had gone to visit her at her studio, and I saw a lot of the paintings that were about to go to London to be in this exhibition. So I thought this summed up some part about her interest in myth. Our trademark of invented nostalgia springs from an awareness of the power of simulation and a knowledge that the real is often disappointing. Ours is a country built on myths, the razzle-dazzle spectacle of their perpetuation. We have a crude, sure-as-shit swagger over history, demanding that it bend at our will. So here's another of Rawson's works. It's cut off, but it's called Bucket of Blood Saloon, destroyed by San Francisco earthquake of 1906. And then I juxtaposed it here with a Theodore Jericho. Because again, in looking at more and more of Rawson's work, it sort of began to point to this high level of theatricality. So, obviously, there's a dialogue going on here with art history, and I thought this was a good place to start in talking about that. Like Jericho, I mean, not to put too much pressure on Rawson to compare her to Jericho, but very highly theatrical, highly dramatic, sort of takes the idea of the real off the table. And here's another. This is Buck Owens' Trophy Room, 2007, by Rawson Crowe and Eugene Delacroix, Liberty Leading the People, from 1830. So again, a similar level of intensity and theatricality here between Buck Owens and paired with Delacroix here. But also in realizing that that the figure is always left out of Rosin's work, this idea that the paintings, these very large-scale paintings, become like ornate backdrops into which we, as the viewer, can become the figure. Here is another work. This work is in the exhibition that will open this Saturday to the public, and it is called Queen's Butcher Shop 1910. And this was in Rosin's studio when I visited her, and it's sort of this, again, this idea of this bloody, grotesque, decadent kind of image, which also made me think about her pattern of kind of the after image of violence and how much that is part of the scene. The action has already taken place, but things are still going on within the image. And this work also made me think of this Anibale Carracci work at the Kimball. And since Rosin is from Plano, I figured she had probably seen this before. But just to do a little basic compare and contrast here with the Carracci painting. In the Carracci painting, the butchers are pretty clean, sort of strapping, heroic, center canvas. Their shop is very tidy. And it's, even though it's heroic, it's a scene really from the everyday. And Rosin's image sort of leaves all of that behind to emphasize the slaughter over the trade. And the kind of the nightmarish portrayal of the butcher shop really also reminded me of this, Francis Bacon. So kind of the same, here's Rosin's butcher shop again. And here are two images by Bacon, both with meat. One is called Painting, and it shows this authority figure flanked or garlanded by meat, and then another figure with meat. So meat is a big theme, huh? but this, again, this idea of sort of this nightmarish portrayal. And whereas Bacon talked a lot about doing portraits from memory, Rosin's are more of composites and research and fantasy, from what I understand of them. Oh, with Bacon, I knew there was another point I wanted to make about this. I just think it's interesting with Bacon, you know, in our old building we had the exhibition in 1999, the retrospective, and I remember in reading the catalog at that time that so much is made of Bacon's own myth. I mean, he made a lot. He perpetuated his own myth a lot. But even in reading, there were several essayists in that catalog, and it's all about his own backstory more than it is the work. So that's another sort of interesting affinity there, that you're so interested in myth. And Bacon was interested in his own myth. So this is our Francis Bacon in the Moderns Collection, self-portrait from 1956. And again, I show it with a work of Rosin's called Montana Men's Booth, the first one that I showed this evening. Again, not to put the pressure on Rosin, but what Bacon does, to my mind, what Bacon does with the figure, Rosin kind of keeps that same level of intensity, but omits the figure, but retains that kind of heavy psychological mood. And, sorry, I'm having trouble clicking. There. Okay. Another quote. I don't know if Rosin will say anything about why she's attracted to masculine environments or not, but this was another quote from the essay that she wrote I thought I would read. It says, "The robust American cowboy enjoyed unmitigated freedom in the hyper-masculine territory of the Western frontier. The cowboy became a symbol of national identity whose dedication to freedom exemplified the cherished democratic ideal and soothed the anxieties of a nation in flux. This man-up masculinity of a bygone era strangely still resonates today, turbulent, violent, cinematic." And that sort of leads me to this work, which is also in the exhibition. This is one of Rosin's very latest works that she created especially for our exhibition here. And it shows a rifle shop. It's called Sharp's Rifle Shop. So I'm not going to say too much about this, but just to say that clearly Ross and Crowe emphasizes the legendary, sort of the legendary aspects of American history, showing us the darker side of patriotism, tradition, and pride. And then a last quote by Rawson. This is the last sentence of her essay. And it says, "So I embraced the cheap spectacle of the frontier baroque, the lewd fakery of the Wild West, cosmetic sublime, the rowdy vulgarity of Texas crude, the obscenity that is America. Love it or leave it, baby." So with that, I introduce to you Rawson Crowe.
Thank you, Andrea. The real reason I wanted her to talk is because I've never given a lecture before, and I'm really, really nervous. So I told her I wanted to have her talk and take up as much time as possible so I wouldn't have to talk at all. But apparently there's still time left, so that's great. So this is not my PowerPoint, but I'm sure it is. Okay. I don't know how to work technology at all either, so. Okay, so, yeah, the show is really important to me because, yes, I'm from Dallas, and so it's kind of like a homecoming kind of thing, and I'm very interested in the West and the history of the West, so I feel like it's a good tie-in and fit. So I'm going to start with work this work starts from 2007, and it was kind of an important time for me in my work because I had just moved to Los Angeles, and previous to moving to Los Angeles, I was living in Paris, and I was doing a residency at the Cité des Arts in Paris for about 8 months. And what I learned in Paris is that I was much more American than I thought. because my work really comes out of a love of history. I've always been fascinated by history and been inspired by it, and history painting and historical spaces. And for a while, I was really obsessed with French history, especially the French Revolution and that particular time period. So thinking I would really enjoy living in Paris and being able to visit these kind of decadent spaces of a bygone era that represented, not only decadence, but political corruption and all that was going on with the French Revolution and French history at that time. Be able to visit Versailles and experience all that, these lavish spaces, which was great. I really enjoyed it and learned a lot, but definitely realized that I think that I was more interested in the American version of Paris in a way, like the Las Vegas version of Paris. I found that somehow much more interesting. So while living in Paris, I found myself just fantasizing about living in LA the whole time, which is kind of awful, but I realized that I was very American. I was really interested in the artifice that is kind of the American stronghold, and I liked the fake facade version of the Hotel de Ville in Las Vegas instead of the real Hotel de Ville. Somehow that was more interesting, kind of the American invention of history, because, us as such a young nation compared to others, we really have such little history, and our nation is built on so much myth of that history that's so small, and we kind of feel free to just borrow from other people's histories and use it, I think that that's, growing up here, it seems very normal, but, the French would never do that. They're so uptight, so. yes, moving to Los Angeles was very freeing and great, and, it's the artifice capital of the world, except maybe Las Vegas would rival that, but, so it's like everything from the palm trees, which are all imported, because Los Angeles is a desert, to everything being basically kind of a film set. When you live there, it's like they're always filming movies everywhere. So you feel like you live in a film set, which is kind of interesting. So I started getting really interested in the history of Los Angeles and Los Angeles spaces. And also, this is when I really started to think about American history painting and how my paintings relate to that, because I'm very interested in history painting and in history, like I said before. And so these paintings are kind of paintings of stage desires and scripted spaces and excess and power and violence that seems to be very American to me. So this painting is The Night at the Palomino, 1984. And this was a very famous honky-tonk bar in Los Angeles where a lot of great country music acts came to play. It was a super small club, you know, smoky bar, dive bar kind of vibe. But it was very legendary. You know, Johnny Cash played there, Patsy Cline, Dwight Yoakam, you know, like a lot of really great people came and played there. And so he became obsessed with it. It doesn't exist anymore. It's now... I think they tore it down, but anyway, so it's got kind of, you know, the American flags and the smoky atmosphere, someplace where you just, rednecks would go and get drunk and fight kind of atmosphere. So yeah, that was interesting to me. Okay. This one is called The Widow Garrett's View of Deadwood. Which is kind of the Hollywood film set version of the Old West. After the Deadwood series kind of inspired that. I'm actually friends with the Widow Garrett on there, so somehow it was kind of an ode to her in the title. But I also love the show, and I love the idea of, you know, staging the West, because I feel like most of the West and our idea, our perception of the West is staged. Like if you go to Tombstone, Arizona, they have, you know, the shootout at the OK Corral restaged every few hours. And so you feel like you're walking through a set, but it's reality, but it's not. So this has kind of like the spotlights and the chandeliers and the carpet pattern, which would make no sense, but is also kind of the Western set going on. So this is Sunday Morning Coming Down, which gets its title from my favorite Johnny Cash song. So this is just, it's a saloon, but it's also, you know, I want my paintings a lot of the time to feel like paintings of stage sets. You know, I want them to be theatrical, but not, you know, not necessarily have the substance of looking like a real space. I'm more fascinated with the idea of a stage set of a space, a recreation. Because really how I got interested in interiors in the first place was from historical period rooms in museums, which are obviously just recreations of rooms and essentially stage sets. So this is a saloon filled with old miner's equipment, like lanterns and picks, and then a chair made out of horns, very Americana things of the period that kind of seem like props. Okay. Flower Shop at the Ambassador, which is a painting of the Ambassador Hotel, which was a legendary hotel in Los Angeles, which was, I think, demolished in 2006. But it was the hotel where Coconut Grove, the famous nightclub, was there. It's the hotel where Bobby Kennedy was shot. But it fell into disarray, I think, in the 70s or 80s. And then after that, it was only used for movies. They filmed movies in there, so it was basically a movie set. And so this is the flower shop in the lobby. This is a painting of the famous case study house, the Koenig House by Pierre Koenig. And it also references the famous Julius Shulman photograph of the Koenig House, which is that photo, the case study house. So it's another famous Los Angeles location, LA, overlooking the city at night. And I kind of just, you know, added a random Frank Stella and chandelier for good measure. Wasn't really decadent enough, so we needed a melting carpet, flowers, and Frank Stella. This painting is, it's called 5 Minutes Late and 2 Bucks Short at the Cha-Cha, which is a painting of a bar by my house in LA called the Cha-Cha Lounge, which is kind of just this dive bar. It's very, the decorations are very Mexican Day of the Dead, a lot of skulls, kind of very over the top, and it has like only red lights, so it's very seedy feeling. And I just like how it's kind of dirty, but decadent at the same time, and somehow very American. I love dive bars, so. And this is the Buck Owens Trophy Room that Andrea talked about. Obviously, I'm kind of obsessed with Buck Owens. I try and incorporate that in a lot of paintings. I love music, especially country music. I mean, growing up in Dallas, so I have a lot of that reference in my work. I always wanted to be a singer, but I have no musical talent, so I had to be a painter. I love the idea of taxidermy. I'm very obsessed with the idea of taxidermy because I think that taxidermy and trophy rooms, I mean, I don't think that it can get more macho and decadent than that. I mean, having, you know, a polar bear and a tiger in your house is kind of ridiculous. it's very much the idea that it's like, I'm going to go out and kill this, and it's going to be mine, and I'm going to put it in my house to show everyone how masculine I am, killing things, and, you know. So I think it's kind of interesting. And I know that Andrea talked a bit about why I always like to paint masculine things, and I think it's just because as a female painter, I mean, the art world is so sexist, as is most of the world, but, you know, I always feel like there's just that part of me as a female painter that is like, oh, well, you know, if you can do that, I can do it way better, you know? So it's like, it's a challenge almost. Like, I like kind of taking on these masculine spaces and creating them and taking them over as a female painter in some way. But, you know, because my name is so androgynous, most people think I'm a man anyway, if they don't know me. So, interesting. let's see. So you talked about this painting also. This is the Montana Men's Booth at the World's Fair 1904, which was in St. Louis. I love the idea of World's Fairs because I don't think they have them anymore. They might, actually, but they seem so weirdly irrelevant because why would you need to have a World's Fair now? You know, because we have the internet and obviously we're so connected globally that you wouldn't need it. But back then, you know, they would have these huge affairs that everyone would come to, and it was a really big deal, and you know, you had to display your best everything of your country, you know, to show the world that you were amazing. And so you know, it's very American. It's got the taxidermy in it again, and this really was a booth that they had that was only for men. You know, men would go there and like smoke cigars and whatever they do. So I was kind of fascinated by the idea of that. So this is the Tea Room at the Plaza, which is in the Plaza Hotel in New York, and set in the early 1900s, but kind of a contemporary feel to it. Just a very kind of decadent, over-the-top interior space set in an exclusive New York hotel. So this is a painting of the late artist Jason Rhodes' installation that he made called The Black Pussy. And I don't know if you guys are familiar with his work, but so he made this installation. There, I have a picture of the installation, I think. Yeah. He made this installation in a warehouse in Los Angeles. That's about 2 miles from my house, actually. But he passed away a few months before I moved to LA. And I never got to see the installation in person. But it kept kind of coming up in my life in weird ways. And I'd seen lots of pictures of it. And I was familiar with his work before and interested in it in a way. Also, you know, there were things I didn't like about it. I feel like we have similar ideas. He was, you know, very into ideas of the West also. I mean, you can't really tell here, but there were a lot of, like, cowboy hats and wagon wheels in this installation. And he was very into neon lights, which I like. You know, the lighting looks like it could be in one of my paintings. And, you know, he was very into making these installations that were whole worlds, total environments, you know, which I thought was interesting. But his work was also all about being very male and macho. And, you know, the whole premise of this installation was to have these parties where they sat around and came up with new words for pussy. So, you know, there's things that as a woman that I'm like, oh, okay, you know. So I kind of was interested in taking that on. Again, saw it as a challenge and interesting. So this is my painting of the black pussy. It's kind of got the stage in the background and all the, you can see the wagon wheels kind of on there. Oh, wait, I think there's a laser pointer in here. Wagon wheels. Neon lights. This was actually the card image for my show in Los Angeles, and my grandmother got it in the mail, and she was like, why does it say black pussy on it? She's so upset. So... let's see. Okay, so now we're getting into the work for my White Cube show, which was up in January of this year. And these paintings are a bit more somber and dark and historical. And everybody was always like, why are you making paintings that are so dark now? And really, it was because I had just broken up with my boyfriend. So I painted a funeral. And so this is Abraham Lincoln's funeral. And also, you know, I was really reading a lot about America and the Gilded Age and kind of thinking a lot about that time period in American history, being really fascinated by it. Because it was a very interesting period, you know, post-Civil War, pre-Great Depression, when our country was really coming into its own economically and politically and culturally. It was a time of unbelievable wealth, decadence, expansion, and spectacle. So there were a lot of kind of interesting things going on in that time period. I wanted to paint a funeral, so I painted Abraham Lincoln's funeral. I think I have reference photos, so you can kind of... Yeah, so this is just an example of, you know, I do a lot of research and spend a lot of time at the library and finding these old images and history books and things like that. So here you have a picture of the hearse that I used as a reference. That was actually Lincoln's hearse, and that was the casket. So you can see the hearse here and the casket. So this painting is of an Alaskan furrier. It's called Dawson City Furrier Caters to Klondike Fever. And so, you know, in this time in American history, there's a lot of westward expansion, ideas of manifest destiny, you know, taking what's yours out in the land. And so... this is kind of an extension of the taxidermy idea, except it's furs. And I don't know, you know, Alaska was kind of fascinating. It's weird. I made this months before I'd ever knew who Sarah Palin was. It was all these paintings became weirdly prophetic in a way. And so it was like people would come into my studio and be like, oh, you've made that because of Sarah Palin. And I was like, no, but it was just kind of interesting. So, then I thought about oil fields. Seems kind of natural because I'm from Texas, but I'd never thought of them before, really. Just kind of taking the idea of manifest destiny and this westward expansion and kind of thinking about the industries that were going on at the time, you know, steel, silver, gold, oil, and all that was happening with that. And I was looking at a lot of photos like this and really loved just the way that they looked and how they become these abstract shapes and forms on the picture plane. And I thought it'd be fun to try and paint them. So, and this is another one called Gusher at Spindletop. And this one's actually in the show also here. And I just, you know, I like the idea of what these oil fields represent. I mean, they're just, they're totally decadent in a different way. I mean, you know, they still represent, you know, this kind of wealth and dominance, just in a different form. So this is the Bucket of Blood Saloon destroyed by San Francisco earthquake of 1906. And the Bucket of Blood Saloon is a real saloon. It's actually in Virginia City, Nevada. But I decided that I should probably set it in San Francisco because I really wanted to make a painting of the earthquake. So, I just wanted to make a painting of something that was being destroyed. In here is, this is a hearse, and it's actually the Bucket of Blood Saloon dead wagon, which they actually did have for the saloon, because I don't know if they just had a lot of people die at the saloon, or they were just multitasking, they were also undertakers, I don't know. So I just thought that was interesting. So it's kind of caught in the rubble. I don't think it's really going to save anyone, but... this painting is the taxidermy sale at Sotheby's, 1908. This painting's a few things. It's, you know, it's an extension of my other taxidermy painting and kind of thinking about that still. But really, it's a joke about the Damien Hirst sale at Sotheby's that happened last year. And I was showing this at White Cube, and I was like, oh, won't it be funny? Because Damien Hirst shows at White Cube, and I'll make this painting that's like a joke about Damien Hirst. But anyway... I don't know if Jay Joplin thought it was that funny, but so that's what that is, yeah. And this is the chandelier that I have in my studio. It's a wagon wheel chandelier from 1940, which I'm very proud of. So I put in a lot of my paintings just because I think it's amazing. Oops. Okay, this is the New York Stock Exchange after Bond Rally, 1919. And this is another painting that became weirdly prophetic because it was made about 5 months before the stock market collapsed, unfortunately. So this is a painting kind of, it's after a bond rally, which is, they would have these bond rallies during the First World War to raise money for the war. They would sell defense bonds or liberty bonds. And so this is kind of after the party. It's a bit depressing, you know, the lights are dimmed, the streamers are, they're done. Hanging, so yeah, it's a bit depressing. But that is like a reference photo of kind of what the stock exchange used to look like. So you can kind of see. Here we have the butcher shop again. So yeah, I had been wanting to paint a butcher shop for a while because my favorite artists are Goya and Bacon and people like that. So it made sense. I don't know why it took me so long to make it, but here it is, and it's gory, and it was a lot of fun to paint. Uh, This is the Poverty Party at the White House. So in the late 1800s, rich people would throw these parties called poverty parties where they pretended to be poor. I think it's like the modern day equivalent would be like a white trash party, I guess. So they would dress up in rags and use like slang, like they were poor, and but they would be eating these lavish dinners, and they were really lavish parties. And the image that inspired this was a picture of the White House decked out for a Christmas dinner in the 1800s. So I kind of just combined the two, that there would be a poverty party at the White House. And so this is the most recent one, Sharp's Rifle Shop. It's actually quite large. It's like 20 feet long. And I thought a rifle shop would be really perfect for Fort Worth. you know, guns, it's good. and yeah, it just kind of brings together all the ideas of the cowboy and the West and the hunter and the, you know, every man for himself kind of attitude, and the masculinity of it, I think is really interesting. But it's also, you know, it's kind of romantic. It's kind of a romantic view of the Old West. Like, this is what you would want a rifle shop to look like if you went back in time and were able to go to one. You would hope it'd be kind of dusty and dirty like that. Yet kind of violent and masculine. Yeah. So that's my work. So I don't know if I talked long enough or said, you know, enough stuff. So anyway, if there are any questions or anything... Yes.
Okay, I'm going to stop. I want you to talk a little bit about the role of the carpet, the floor. I mean, it just seems like such a device to everyone.
Yeah, no, I think that having a carpet and also a chandelier or some sort of... It's almost like a framing device, you know, that I can hang the rest of the picture on. Because I do want them to have a realistic space somewhat, and somehow having a floor pattern, which is usually a carpet, is grounding. You know, it's realistic and lets you enter the picture on that. So if there's that, if there's a light fixture or some things that are recognizable spatially, then it's like the rest could be more abstract, I think. Yes?
I'm really impressed by not just the size of the works, but the large number of them. This is quite an accomplishment. But I do have a question about how you handle such large canvases. Being obviously a relatively petite person.
Well, I have a ladder. And
you paint vertically.
Yes, I do paint vertically, and... you know, I paint very fast, too. I think that it's important for me, for the paintings to have a kind of a speed to them, almost. I would never want them to seem fussy. I want them to be kind of exuberant and brash, in a way. So I think that working fast or making myself work fast on the paintings helps that. Yeah. Thanks. Yes?
What role does drawing play?
Drawing. You know what? I'm not a good drawer, so not a very good... not very much of a role. I mean, I don't consider myself a draftsman at all. It's more a means to an end. I mean, I do draw on the canvases, you know, to get a composition planned out, a sketch, whatever. But it's much more means to an end to just get an idea and then to start painting, because I consider myself much more of a painter than a drawer, I think. Yes, you?
We talked about the subject of the main painting. What about the track marks that you made over the painting?
Oh, like the white part that's on there? That is... often done afterwards. It's like an enamel that I use. And I think that it relates partially to the kind of the fact that I want them to have this energy and speed. But it's also, I think, me messing with the picture plane and wanting to almost cause a disruption to the image, because I don't want it to be totally straightforward. So I want there to be that kind of stopping point, or at least a challenge for the viewer to entering the space. You know, kind of, does that make sense? Yeah. Okay, pink shirt.
Hi. Looking in the galleries past the tapes and taking different angled views, I noticed, and then your photographs even more so, this role of the chandelier. I wonder if you could elaborate a little more. It seems to me it not only illuminates the space, but it seems to be the fount of a lot of the gestural light. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Well, I love chandeliers. It's kind of an addiction, as is sparkly dresses. and I mean, as I said earlier, I think that the chandeliers are an important anchoring device, as is the floor and the carpet pattern for me in the paintings, because I can make everything else more abstract around it. And I think that, you know, they're these decadent objects somehow to me, that as is carpets, these kind of lush patterned carpets. And so somehow, I don't know, they just end up in each painting, and then, you know, they do illuminate the space and, you know, have the lighting. And also, I often use a lot of white when I'm going over with these kind of, you know, strokes of bravado kind of enamel. And I think that somehow that means light to me. And that's how it relates to the chandelier in some way. Yeah.
Do the chandelier and the floor in any way represent a more feminine?
I don't know. I mean, there is the feminine aspect of the work, meaning that it's, you know, they're interiors, and often you could relate that to domestic or things like that, which might be considered more feminine. But I don't know if they're necessarily more feminine. I don't necessarily think of them as more feminine. But I'm not opposed to that. Yes?
Actually, I have a few things to say about the chandelier as well. If you're going to have a myth about the chandelier itself, one thing that they're known for is falling. Shot down or something. Knowing that, it adds to the chaos of the work.
Uh-huh.
But also, I was wondering, a lot of these scenes kind of remind me of this kind of fuzzy personal memories of, like, abandoned buildings and disorganized closets when the light is turned off. And I'm wondering if maybe they reminded you of memories as well. And also, if you could explain a little bit about the technical evolution of your work. Like, did you always paint real gestural, or did you try out different ways of working?
Yeah, okay, so the first question. Yes, they do kind of have this memory resonance for me also, and I kind of want them to be vague so other people read them as that, perhaps. I mean, I'm very much interested in memory, and especially in related to history and our own personal histories and myths and things like that, and how we remember things, which is not always accurate. And so definitely interested in that. And the way that I paint, I did not always paint this way, but it's just kind of been an evolution, I guess. When I first started painting seriously in art school, I used a lot of spray paint and tape and stenciling and things like that, a lot of enamel, which I still use a bit. And also I use tape in my process a lot. Like, a lot of this is taped off, but I use it in a very kind of abstract way. And a lot of layering still, I definitely keep that. But now it's mostly oil paint, and I think that just me using oil paint and moving into that made it much more gestural in the way that I paint now. It relates more to the medium because it was just kind of goopier and oily stuff going on instead of spray paint. So, yes?
Hi, I always wanted to ask you this ever since I became familiar with your work when you did French Rococo interiors.
Uh-huh.
Did you get some of those carpet patterns from the movie The Shining?
Oh yeah, I'm obsessed with that carpet. There's a ton of them. I've used it in a lot of paintings. A lot of paintings. I just changed the colors, yeah. Yes?
I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about the absence of the human figure, especially since it's such a basic part of traditional history painting.
Mm-hmm. Well, when I first started painting and being interested in history painting, I did have figures in them. And then I realized that I was much more interested in the space and not the figures at all. In fact, I hated painting the figures. And they looked kind of awkward because I wasn't good at it, and it was like boring part of the painting for me. And so I was like, why am I even putting them in here? Because I think that the spaces themselves have so many representations of human presence without the humans needing to be there, or the figures. You know, they're obviously human objects and things either left behind or just about to, you know, it's like the room could have just been abandoned or abandoned 100 years ago. And I like what the objects represent and what they mean to the people that could have inhabited the space. And also, as the work got bigger, really thinking about how the figures didn't need to be in the space because the viewer could really enter the space then. You know, you were kind of the figure in the space in the painting. And, I like the idea of them being much more like theater backdrops than paintings with figures in them, because I want them to kind of be this space that envelops you or is, you know, very overwhelming, that you can enter almost. Yeah. Any more questions? Yeah.
I do your color choices.
Uh-huh.
I mean, you're looking at a lot of black and white photos, obviously.
Yes.
How do you all of a sudden, what do you say to yourself on your color choices?
I don't know. You know, it's usually pretty intuitive somehow. If I'll get an idea of a painting from just a black and white photo, which is usually the case, somehow I'll think of a color of what I want the mood to be of the space, and then it just comes naturally almost.
And are you limiting that to like three colors? How many colors do you see yourself using? I'm first time I've seen your work.
Uh-huh.
Kind of stuck back there and looked a little bit, and, which I was just like, wow, these are great. And I did think Francis Bacon right off the bat.
Mm-hmm.
Whoa.
Mm-hmm.
But I haven't heard you really say anything about Francis Bacon too much on that. But your color choices seem very limited back there.
Those paintings are, they're darker, I don't ever limit my color choice. I try and use as many as possible, even if they're just, you know, very small variations on the same color. I have a huge palette and use a lot of paint and a lot of color variations. But yeah, those paintings, they're a bit darker. Then. Oh, thank you. Mm. Yes?
How long does it take to paint a picture that took an hour of work?
I don't know, in hours. I generally work, you know, I like to work fast. I'll block out a whole day of time when I can work, the whole day, so 8 or 10 hours. And then I'll work a whole day and then I'll have to let it dry a week or two so I can work on it again. But usually 3 of those days. So, yes?
Everything looks kind of so spontaneous after you like lay down like the floor and like the background and the room itself. How do you keep that same kind of energy going if you have to wait 2 weeks between like sessions?
Well, that's why I always work in one day, because I feel like if I was working on it in between, it wouldn't seem as spontaneous. You know, it'd be more fussy if I was working on like this part and then that. I guess it's, you know, when I am able to let it dry for a week or two and then work on it again, it's almost like starting over again on the whole painting, you know, so it's like working on everything all at once. So it you do have to work kind of fast, and it is still, I try and keep it spontaneous. Yeah. Yes?
The store fixtures in this one do seem fussy to me, and they're quite identical. You do that as a projection, or are you just really, really a much better grass person than you'll admit?
No, I do use a projector sometimes. Yeah. I'll draw them out smaller and then sometimes project them, but not always. But yes, for those I did because I wanted them to seem, you know, be straight. But a lot of that is just the tape also. It's a lot of taping to make a straight line, which is it's pretty easy and fast, but, you know, it gives the illusion that I can paint a straight line. Anything else? Yes?
I was wondering, about how there's a level of spontaneity to it. Mm-hmm. How often is like the picture you start out with in your head, does the finished product look like that? Or do you like go with the flow and add things?
It never looks like I want it to. Which is fine. It's like I'll be happy with the finished product, but it never looks like I saw it in my head when I get the idea. Which I actually like because I think, you know, I don't ever paint things directly from one photograph. I'm always kind of combining different things because that makes it exciting for me. And I would not want to paint a picture that already exists because it already exists. So I'd want to paint something else. So I'm combining different things and I'm changing things. And I like to keep things, you know, loose and open to not make it boring for me. And so it hardly ever turns out as I plan, but that's okay. Yeah?
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Can you talk about the lighting? Like, I've noticed that your lighting is really strong, like all these pieces. Is that something that came naturally, or is it more like something you had to study for a while to understand it?
I think it's definitely evolved over time and just working on things. I think it's definitely better than it was, but I didn't study it specifically. I don't know. Yeah.
I wanted to ask one last question.
Okay.
I'm just interested in this notion of your entry with myth and the fact that you decided to be a painter. Mm-hmm. And if there's a relationship between the act of painting and myth making, that has any.
Well, I really wanted to be a country music singer. Or an actress. This was third choice. No. I think, you know, I always wanted to be a performer in some way. And I think that the paintings for me are very performative and theatrical. And I just love making them. I think that there's that, which is, you know, performers create their own myths also. So definitely it's a tie-in to the myth and my fascination with that, for sure. Oh, one more question. Okay.
Where did you go to school in Dallas?
I went to Plano Senior High School.
did you do art there?
I did, yes. All right. Well, thank you guys for coming to my first lecture.